You're listening to American Prestige. To listen ad-free, you can subscribe at AmericanPrestigePod.com. Find the link in our show notes.
This episode is brought to you by Facebook. So you were scrolling on Marketplace, and there it was, the bike you'd been searching for. You sent a message, and it turned out the seller was super chatty, kind of funny, and an avid cyclist. The next thing you know, you're in a cycling crew. Well, a community cycling group. The thing about Facebook, you might find more than what you're looking for. From a browse to a bike ride, this summer, find more on Facebook.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the mind.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, and I am very pleased to be joined. I think for the first time on the show, we've got Daniel Bessner. That's right, Bessner. I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah,
he's from the University of Washington.
Bessner.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, Bessner. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm still learning on the job. He's from the University of Washington, and he's got a book, Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century. Boy, that sounds like a good one.
You weren't sure right. If you weren't going to go with sounds like a good one, and you cut yourself off from the joke.
Yeah, no, I did. I should have had AI write the intro, actually, to this.
Yeah, AI makes no mistakes.
All right, so basically what we're going to do here is sell copies of Danny's book. You guys need to pick it up, and he's going to get to say... a lot of the things that he says on the show anyway, but in a format where I'm asking him questions instead of, you know, us bantering. So, Danny, how's it going?
It's going good, Derek. It feels nice to have this book out. You know, I developed this idea in an article I actually wrote for The Drift, I think in 2021. So, you know, I've been working on this idea for about 5 years. Also, before we dive in, I've actually, you know, you're truly my sensei, my mentor, my literal mentor for all the people who've seen The Odyssey.
Yes.
Derek, mentor Davison. But I'm also starting a Substack with the same title, Imperialist Realism. So I hope to bring the analysis we're going to talk about forward. By the time people are listening to this, the Substack will be launched. It will have one piece, but we're going to put a bunch of free stuff out relatively quickly. The first piece... it's called Empire of Grunge, How William Boeing Made Kurt Cobain. So bringing together a lot of threads that I'm interested in. So please check that out at Imperialist Realism over at Substack. So I wanted to plug that first because I think this is a type of work.
Is that up now, Imperialist Realism?
I think it might actually be up. Yeah, I think by the time people are listening to this, it'll definitely be up. It'll either be up now, Derek, or right after we record this conversation. But the point being is that, like, there's a lot of... on this show, we really do.
It is actually up. I was unaware of this. All right, we'll see. This changes everything. I have to, like, put it in my recommendations.
We'll tell you.
A lot of work for me.
We want to make everything's up. But is the Josh art up? I got our old friend Josh Lynch to do the...
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It looks like it. Yeah,
All right, guys.
So, all right, breaking news here. Prestige. Danny's Substack is ready. There's no pieces up yet, but it's ready for you to go and subscribe to
right,
it.
Right, right. By the time you hear this, there will definitely be at least one piece up, perhaps even two. But the point being, you know, this show, we have fun, but it is more serious. I want the Substack to be more fun, really to focus on the type of cultural stuff, Derek, that you read in the introduction. For this book, Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century, which is what this episode is on. So also, please consider buying the book. I think people who like my writing will enjoy the book. And then also, please consider joining the Substack. There'll always be free posts. So if you can't, you know, swing the dough, you'll still have something there. And that'll be more, you know, more fun pieces on culture and stuff. But all right, Derek, that's that. But ready to, you're leaving
all
this radio.
All the plugging. So Why don't we? I mean, you started out down this road, but talk about the genesis of the book. I mean, some of the book is, you know, sort of a collection of essays or a reworked essay material into other contexts. I know there were a couple of pieces that you wrote for my Substack.
Yep.
That were involved part of this. So, talk about just the before we get into the substance of the book. Talk about the genesis of it.
Sure. So, I was writing this piece for the Drift, you know, during high COVID on the Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War game. And I went into the piece, like I think a lot of people from our political perspective would, thinking that this is going to be, if not totally rah-rah empire, you know, at least sort of like somewhat rah-rah empire or somewhat in favor of what the United States does abroad. And I was really surprised to find that this was not what it was in any way, shape, or form. That the video game was actually presented American operators as essentially, to put a fine point on it, like psychopaths. They were just fucking psychopaths. That there were essentially no good guys. They weren't even, they were fighting, I guess, in service of a greater, as you could hear, I'm also in New York. So I'm sure the mic is picking up those bad boys. So we'll give.
Have we ever interviewed somebody who was in New York City and there wasn't at one point a siren?
There is always a siren
in the middle of the interview. It was, you know, it's incredible.
Make it play like fun, beautiful music. The call to prayer. But Derek's laughing at that one, guys. But anyway, I was surprised to find this, and so I started to think through like what's going on with this notion, and I developed in that essay this concept of imperialist realism, which was sort of a bare bones concept, which is the notion that after 20 years of the failed war on terror, after the United States essentially being unable to achieve any of its strategic goals in the world, I mean, in a really long time, I would argue since the 1990s, I think we disagree with the strategic goals that the United States achieved in the 1990s, but they did achieve a sort of type of unipolarity, a hyperpower, a global hegemony. But really since 2001 and the war on terror, the United States hasn't achieved any strategic goals. And so I argued that this led to an imperialist realism, a very significant awareness that the United States is an empire. The empire doesn't do good in the world, but that you must nevertheless do your job. Actually, in the Call of Duty video game, it's kind of based on the Manchurian Candidate, and your main character is brainwashed, and you have a trigger phrase, and the trigger phrase is, "We've got a job to do," which I just thought was the perfect encapsulation of this imperialist realism idea, which is that even if you don't believe in it, you've got a job to do, so you go and do it. So that's where I introduced the concept. And I began to see it really all over the place in American popular culture. And I thought there was really something there, and that one can think of the writing that I've done since 2018 or so as being, you know, examining various pieces of an imperialist realism, the sort of cynicism of various policymakers, their missionism, and then this tragic guilt, which are the three core features of imperialist realism. But I don't want to get into that yet. But Derek, just to answer your question, that was the genesis of the idea.
Hi, folks, it's Derek, and this episode is brought to you by Vinted. We all have that one closet drawer that we've been avoiding for years, right? Clothes you keep saying you'll wear but never do. You know, there may be real money just sitting in there doing nothing. You should try Vinted. It's a secondhand app that makes it easy for everyday sellers, people like you and me, to sell pre-loved fashion and earn extra cash. Listing takes minutes, and with no seller fees, you keep everything you earn. Once something's sold, Vinted even generates the prepaid shipping label for you. Make your closet a little lighter, your wallet a little heavier, and honestly, change how you think about your clothes with Vinted. Are you ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money? Download the Vinted app for free and start listing. With no seller fees, you keep every dollar you earn, and for a limited time, enjoy free shipping in the U.S. on Vinted. Hi, folks. It's Derek here to talk to you about Mint Mobile. When we were kids, summer meant freedom. No homework, no teachers, no school. And as adults, summer still means freedom thanks to Mint Mobile's summer sale. Right now, all of Mint's plans are $15 per month, even unlimited. So free yourself from big wireless and all their gimmicks and gotchas and switch to Mint for high-speed data and coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network. You heard me right. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right with premium wireless for $15 a month on the nation's largest 5G network, high-speed data, unlimited talk and text. Bring your current phone number, even your current phone. Choose from 3, 6, or 12-month plans and say goodbye to a monthly bill. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile. It's so easy. Sign up online and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/American Prestige, all one word. That's mintmobile.com/American Prestige. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/American Prestige. That's it. There's no catch. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required, $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com for details. So, imperialist realism, let's talk about what it is for ordinary people. I mean, in the context of the game, in the context of like portraying an operator, it's, you know, the empire's not great, but you have a job to do. But for ordinary people, I mean, I guess you could say it the same way, but the job is to sort of just shut up and don't think too hard about stuff, right? Or to just sort of resign yourself to the fact that this is the way it is. So what does it mean for, you know, somebody who's going to be, who would buy this book or, you know, is in this audience, most of the people in this audience, what does that concept mean for them?
Derek, if most of the people in this audience buy this book, I think it might be the best-selling book of the last 10
years. Well, I mean, look, you know, we're going to try to astroturf it, but we don't really have the money for that.
Yeah,
that's what all the think tanks do.
Gaddafi, right? They bought the little green book. Like, they bought, like, 100,000 copies of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, every one of these, like, AEI psychopaths, they just buy a shit ton of, like, the institution buys a ton of the books and, you know, jacks
give
up
them
the,
out as a,
yeah, bestseller list.
To people. Yeah. So anyway, guys, wouldn't it be amazing if you woke up next Monday and imperialist realism was on the New York Times bestseller list? That is within your power.
That's right. It's within your power to do it.
Within your power. You have agency in this world. The only agency you have is to consume. So let's use it for good. I'm just kidding. So basically, for ordinary people, it is obviously a riff for people who know this writer, Mark Fisher. I actually consciously published this book at the same press that Fisher founded, this British theorist, Mark Fisher, founded, and he wrote his famous book, Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative, and published it at this press. And what Fisher argues in relation to capitalism is that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And the notion that we have all these fantasies in popular culture and literature about apocalypse. Fisher was writing at a bit of an earlier moment, but, you know, zombie apocalypses, the various Roland Emmerich type movies, we all know what I'm talking about, that there's all of these visions of alternative futures that essentially end with destruction, and there's no vision of an alternative future in which capitalism is transcended. Well, there were visions like that. I mean, think of Star Trek. Star Trek is genuinely imagining a world where capitalism doesn't exist at the height of Fordist capitalism in the 60s. And so all the Star Trek movies are really a part of a tradition that is able to imagine alternative futures. And Fisher was arguing that that wasn't the case for capitalism. And so I arrived at this notion independently of Fisher, but I thought that it really rhymed with it, that we are all aware, even the most normie American is, I think, aware. And you see this in particular with polls in relation to the Iran war, that the United States is not able to reform the world in its liberal, democratic, progressive, and capitalist image. Now, we probably, most people listening to this podcast, do not believe that the United States has ever lived up to that fantasy of what it presented to the world. But for those of you who are old enough to remember, in the wake of 2001, I believe that there was a genuine feeling amongst the American population, and perhaps even amongst some policymakers, maybe not the Dick Cheneys or the Paul Wolfowitzes of the world, but I think George W. Bush thought he was doing good in the world. Maybe that says something about George W. Bush. But there was this hope that the United States would be able to use its awesome power to genuinely force the world down a progressive direction. And this is actually, I would argue, one of the key features of American foreign policy thinking going back to the founding of the Republic. From basically 1776 until the 1920s through the 1940s, that is really the transition moment. The United States and its elite really did imagine itself as a city on a hill that would dominate the Western Hemisphere militarily, but when it came to the old world, which is really the world of Europe that Americans, elites at least, cared about for most of the first 175 years of the nation's history, they would show a new path forward. And then in World War II, a bit earlier, that transformation became much more active, where instead of being shining a light unto the world, the city would go out and they would force that goddamn light upon people. But there was this notion, and I believe deeply felt, that the United States would force capital H history in a capital P progressive direction. And I think what is really unique about the last 20, maybe even last 10 years, less so 20 years, is that I don't believe that most Americans think that. There were moments, of course, in American history, I would argue, particularly after Watergate and the failures of Vietnam, the sort of church committee era of the mid to late 1970s, where there was this increasing pessimism and cynicism about American power, but that was quickly snuffed out by Reagan. I think what we're witnessing here is a structural transformation in which many Americans, elite and or, quote-unquote ordinary, the average American, people like you and me, are much more cynical and pessimistic about what the United States is able to do in the world. And that brings us, I think, to the first key feature of imperialist realism, which is this cynicism, which is this notion that the United States is not able to act justly or morally or even effectively, pragmatically in the world, that we're not living in the 1990s Madeleine Albright moment where the United States is able, I'll paraphrase her quote, which she made on the Today Show, I believe in 1998, that the United States is able to see further than other nations and is therefore, that is the justifying logic of acting in the world.
More fundamentally to me than that is the cognitive dissonance that I think this puts everybody through. And this is related, I think, to one of the fundamental features of the age that we're living in and imperialist realism, which is the end of mass politics. And you talk about this in the book, you've talked about it on the show. What are the parameters here? When did the United States truly have a mass politics and how long did that last? Because it wasn't very long. And why and how did it start to disappear? I think in the realms of foreign policy, before a lot of other areas, although it's become a disconnect that extends to many other things as well.
So what Derek is getting at is that I argue that there are two structuring historical, one might even say materialist features that enable the rise of materialist realism. The first, as I just mentioned, was the failure of the global war on terror, which is the more proximate cause. And the longer cause is this thing that I've dubbed the end of mass politics. So the United States, I would argue, never had a genuinely mass politics ever. Certainly for the first 150 or 50 so years of its history, from roughly 1776 until 1921, for example, women weren't able to vote. There were enslaved people of African descent. There were indigenous people who were denied rights very early on until Jacksonian democracy. People who were white and didn't meet certain parameters weren't able to vote. Then you have Jim Crow lasting until the 1960s. So from a formal sense, even just looking at like the franchise, the ability to vote in free and fair elections, the United States never had a mass democracy. However, it did have a mass politics at certain moments. Particularly, I would argue, the high water mark of American mass politics was the 1930s. In the wake of the Great Depression and as the New Deal was being formed, as the labor movement was reaching its 20th century height, you were, as an ordinary person, able to organize yourself in masses and then pressure the government to do certain things, even if it was to stave off revolution. And I think historians like Eric Rauchway and others have effectively argued that the New Deal did have a genuinely progressive agenda, but a key part of it was to prevent a revolution in the United States that had occurred with Nazism in Germany and fascism in Italy. And so the New Deal was essentially an anti-fascist program in the sense that it was meant to prevent the explosion of a fascist mass movement in the United States. And my take on the New Deal ultimately is that it was for the masses, but it wasn't technically of the masses. But what it did do is that it did suggest that in this country, the United States, there were parameters for a mass politics of people to organize in groups and actually get things done. I think that this possibility was essentially closed off in the immediate post-World War II period, as Derek already gestured to, primarily, at first at least, in the realm of foreign policy, and continued in other arenas, particularly the civil rights movement and social areas. And you get the social movements of the post-civil rights movement. You get the gay rights movements, you get the women's liberation movements, which is obviously 50 years after suffrage, women's suffrage was achieved. You get the Chicano movements and various other movements today, even down until today with the trans rights movement. So those politics have always existed, but they were really clearly cut off in the realm of foreign policy. I argue by institutional design. The National Security Act of 1947 was, I think, key to closing off mass politics when it came to foreign policy. It created the National Security Council, created the Central Intelligence Agency. It created the precursor to what would become the Department of Defense. You get the National Security Agency in the early 1950s. And you basically get the creation of a state structure that is by design, not only elite, but like mega elite, like Ivy League educated elite. You're appointed by the president to become national security advisor, and you're not subject to any type of Senate confirmation. This is how someone like McGeorge Bundy, who didn't really have policy experience, enters the government. This is someone like how Henry Kissinger, who also didn't really have policy experience, enters the government. And I think what you've seen over the last 70 so years since 1947, I guess it's almost 80 years now, is that you've seen the creep of that sort of hyper-elitist structure to other issue areas. It was always somewhat present in economics with the Fed. Federal Reserve is obviously not a democratic institution. But I think particularly in the realm of foreign policy and economics, you get these institutional mechanisms plus the creation of a parastatal structure of think tanks that essentially cordon off those issue areas from mass political influence. And so I think that the end of mass politics in the 1940s and its expansion to other issue areas is the other structuring condition of the cynicism that allows imperialist realism to be what I argue is the affect of the age, or I think borrowing from Raymond Williams, the structure of feeling of the current moment, that this sort of notion that you can't change things, so a little bit, why even try? And I think, though Anton, I'm not sure Jaeger talks about this, I think it's those two features are also the key structuring feature of hyperpolitics as well, which is politics becoming essentially a cultural thing disconnected from the classic definition of politics, which is who gets what, when, where, and why. Becoming more of a self-identity thing as opposed to something linked directly to material goods or material transformation.
And this is why everybody's walking around with a headache all the time, right? I mean, this is part of the reason why people are losing their minds, I think. This idea that politics is both omnipresent in your identity and in who you are, but useless on some level because it doesn't do the things that it used to do. Like you can't affect, it's very difficult to envision affecting any change. And when you're in an age where there's greater and greater levels of media availability for people to see, talking specifically about foreign policy here, but it's everywhere now, but specifically in foreign policy, which in the past you could say was closed off even in an access sense, like a media sense. Yes, you had reporting from war zones, you had, you know, but it was all gate kept, and it's not like that anymore. And I think people get more, they get inundated with more information or more awareness of what the United States is doing in the world at the same time that they're feeling that they can do anything about that is at like zero because there is no evidence that you can affect these structures.
Precisely. And I think that this idea is, I think, common in the North Atlantic world, and I think each country is going to have different features. And I think this might bring us to the next key feature of imperialist realism, the first one being cynicism. Next one is missionism, which I think emerges from the Protestant heritage of this country that, you know, you see all over the place. You see it in evangelical Christianity in particular, but it was also a mainline Protestant thing. And I think what scholars like David Hollinger have demonstrated is that over the course of the middle of the 20th century, this mainline Protestant missionary impulse secularized as the mainline Protestant movements declined. I believe there's seven, don't quote me on that, but as those movements declined, there became a secular missionism that particularly expressed itself in Cold War foreign policy. So I think on the one hand, you have the cynicism born of the war on terror, born of the end of mass politics. But then you also have this missionism, which is this notion that the United States must nevertheless still act in the world, which I think is really linked to this Protestant heritage that is deep in the United States' history. And you don't have to be literally Protestant to believe in it. There are many Catholics and Jews and people of other identities who also believe in it because it is this notion of secularized mission. So at the same time that you have cynicism about the ability to transform the world, you have this concomitant idea that you must nevertheless act in the world. And I think we could get to this in a bit, Derek, if you want to talk about missionism at all, but I think this is also directly related to modern liberalism, which I think is this form of secularized Protestantism. And I think that secularized Protestantism really makes itself felt in American foreign policy, really key.
Yeah, it's the sense that you even hear people say it now, which didn't used to be the case. I mean, the rhetoric about the U.S. used to be uniformly shining city on a hill type stuff. But, you know, you even start to hear people in relatively significant positions in the foreign policy structure say things like, you know, we may not be perfect, but if the United States isn't leading, then somebody else is going to lead, and that would be worse. Or nobody will lead, and it'll just be chaos, and that'll be worse. And there's never any positive alternative offered to, even in the context of criticizing U.S. leadership of the world. There never seems to be any positive alternative that gets offered.
And it really surprised me when I dug into what was said about the United States is sending weapons of Ukraine to Ukraine. I mean, this was early 2022. It was right in the, you know, sort of the height of the Biden administration, an administration that came in framing international politics as a struggle between democracy and authoritarianism. And so when I was reading the speeches of Antony Blinken, or I was reading the speeches of Lloyd Austin, I was expecting to find some sort of, this is a great struggle for democracy. This is akin to the great struggle of the Cold War. This was what we did in the 1950s. It's something that's going to be crucially important. But what really surprised me and helped me develop this concept was that you saw absolutely none of that. What you just saw was Blinken and Austin basically speaking in the language of pure power politics, that the reason that the United States sent weapons to Ukraine was not to defend democracy, but was to basically ensure that Russia didn't expand for essentially realist, interest-based reasons, that this wasn't a grand ideological project. You just needed to prevent the expansion of a power that could threaten the United States and its allies. So even at this moment, when you would expect something about democracy and authoritarianism, this grand struggle that Biden himself came in trumpeting, you find nothing. And I think this is also related to an argument that, Derek, you know, I've made about the end of ideology here. But the unique feature of the age when it comes to imperialist realism is that you have this decline of ideology at the same moment that you still have this missionism this notion that you need to act in the world. And I think this is a very peculiarly American thing, maybe North Atlantic thing. I haven't done enough reading. If I had to guess, you'd find it much more in England or the UK rather than you would in France and Germany. I haven't done that work. I'm not sure. If someone else wants to pick up sort of imperialist realism in different countries, I'm sure you'd find rhymes, but not the exact same thing. But you really find this new thing here where no one really believes in the United States, but they nevertheless argue that the United States must act in the world if you're an elite. And if you're just, you know, some guy playing Call of Duty, you're like, yeah, all these guys are really messed up. They do crazy things, but I can't really do anything about it. So I'm just going to continue to play my video games. And I think the Iran war, unfortunately, the Iran war happened after I handed in the book, the final manuscript, but I think it's a perfect example of it. The end of mass politics, the sort of cynicism of the war on terror. No one thinks the United States is going to make Iran a better place. There's extraordinary dissatisfaction with the war, but also no one thinks that they're going to be able to really change it. And it is this sort of perfect example of imperialist realism. And when you're the elite, they still believe that the United States needs to do it. They need to act. They need to contribute to this quote-unquote mission.
Hi, folks. It's Derek here to talk to you about Mint Mobile. When we were kids, summer meant freedom. No homework, no teachers, no school. And as adults, summer still means freedom thanks to Mint Mobile's summer sale. Right now, all of Mint's plans are $15 per month, even unlimited. So free yourself from big wireless and all their gimmicks and gotchas and switch to Mint for high-speed data and coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network. You heard me right. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right with premium wireless for $15 a month. On the nation's largest 5G network, high-speed data, unlimited talk and text. Bring your current phone number, even your current phone. Choose from 3, 6, or 12-month plans and say goodbye to a monthly bill. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile. It's so easy. Sign up online and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/American Prestige, all one word. That's mintmobile.com/American Prestige. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/American Prestige. That's it. There's no catch. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required, $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 gigabyte hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com for details. Hi, folks, it's Derek, and this episode is brought to you by Vinted. We all have that one closet drawer that we've been avoiding for years, right? The clothes you keep saying you'll wear but never do. You know, there may be real money just sitting in there doing nothing. You should try Vinted. It's a secondhand app that makes it easy for everyday sellers, people like you and me, to sell pre-loved fashion and earn extra cash. Listing takes minutes, and with no seller fees, you keep everything you earn. Once something's sold, Vinted even generates the prepaid shipping label for you. Make your closet a little lighter, your wallet a little heavier, and honestly, change how you think about your clothes with Vinted. Are you ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money? Download the Vinted app for free and start listing. With no seller fees, you keep every dollar you earn, and for a limited time, enjoy free shipping in the U.S. on Vinted. So one of the things you said on the show in the past, in terms of the death of ideology in the 20th century, is that this is not the outlier. Like this time that we're living in, where ideology is not, you know, the driving force of things, is more than the historical norm. Is that fair to say? So I guess, can we draw some analogies to ages, you know, 19th century and before, maybe, in terms of how this functions?
Yeah, so I think that what one might identify as the modern era, really the post-French Revolutionary era, is perhaps, I mean, future historians, the two wealthy millionaires who will be able to be future historians, will look at, is that I think that the era of the post-1789 period might have been uniquely ideological. And it makes sense if you think about it, because that era, Hobbes Baum identifies the dual revolutions, the political revolution of the French Revolution and then the materialist revolution of the Industrial Revolution. And so what people have been fighting over since 1789, roughly speaking, is that how are you going to organize what comes out of the industrial and later post-industrial revolutions? Are you going to organize it along fascist lines? Are you going to organize it along communist lines? Are you going to organize it along capitalist lines? And of course, particularly communism and capitalism, less so fascism, within those two broad categories, there are very, very clear, you know, there's social democracy, there's neoliberal capitalism, there's Fordist capitalism, there's Bolshevism, there's Menshevism, there's subcategories within those two much broader communist and capitalist categories. But I think the last 200 plus years can be identified as those ideologies really driving history. And I think at the present moment, I want to make clear, I'm not saying this is going to be the forever moment, because things naturally change. They change due to endogenous reasons, internal reasons or exogenous reasons, external reasons. I don't think we're always going to be living in the present moment, but I do think that in the period since 1989, we have been living in a world where one of those key structuring ideologies, capitalist structure, and particularly the liberal capitalist structure in the West and autocratic capitalism in China and Russia, has essentially dominated. So I think we might be entering a moment in which that question was how to organize the fruits of the Industrial Revolution and what came after has been answered, again, at least for the moment, not forever, and has been answered with capitalism. And I think what you see is that ideology as a key feature of international relations, grand ideological struggle, has essentially withered away. And you even see it in the United States by comparing the George W. Bush national security strategy with the Biden and Trump national security strategies, both of which focus much more on interests and less so on things like democracy promotion, particularly the Trump national security strategy than one might imagine. And interestingly, you see something similar in the China national security strategy, which I think mentions ideology and socialism. I forgot the direct numbers, less than 20 times, but mentions things like security hundreds of times. And something similar with Russia, which really barely mentions ideology as a structuring condition. So I think that you're seeing as these grand historical questions have seemingly been answered, you're seeing the slow withering away of ideological justifications. And this is different, just I want to make clear, than what Francis Fukuyama argued in 89. He argued that liberalism would be the last ideology. I'm saying that ideologies themselves are going away. Or what Daniel Bell argued in 1960 with his book, The End of Ideology, which is essentially an argument that we had as sort of a North Atlantic world converged on the perfect way to manage the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, basically a mixed economy of social democratic and liberal capitalist elements. I'm not saying either of those. I'm saying literally ideological justification on the grand scale is withering away, just to answer Derek's question directly.
I want to get into pop culture, but maybe we should say a little bit more about the failure of the war on terror. You talked about it earlier in the interview, but just in terms of this, the emergence of this attitude of like feeling guilty about things in the United States and stuff, but not really changing any of them or you know, letting that affect your priors. But so talk a little bit more about, you know, what went on here in the early, you know, the 2000s and the 2010s to contribute to this.
I think that the war on terror was presented as a grand ideological project akin to the war against fascism during World War II and the war against communism in the Cold War. As many people are probably aware, I think since the United States decided to become a global superpower in the early 1940s and then was able to achieve it in the period after World War II, it needed a justifying enemy in order to do that, because the deeper, I would argue, strand of American intellectual history has actually been skeptical of extra-hemispheric projects. There are examples of it, particularly the occupation of the Philippines between the late 19th century and July 4th, 1946, which is when the Philippines was, quote-unquote, granted independence. But I do think those were exceptions to prove the rule. Most American elites were skeptical about direct governance of territories and extrahemispheric intervention. And so in order to justify the type of extrahemispheric intervention that happened during and after World War II and the Cold War, you needed to identify an existential enemy, first with fascism and then with communism. And I'm not going to talk about whether it was true or not with relation to fascism or communism. I think it was more true with relation to Nazism and fascism and less true with relation to Soviet communism. But let's just bracket that. The point was that the United States government presented these enemies as existential. The problem after the end of the Cold War is that you no longer had a genuinely existential enemy. This was actually talked about at the time. There was this notion of the peace dividend, which was that with the Cold War over, that the United States would be able to close down its military bases, would be able to reduce the defense budget, would be able to refocus on domestic enemies. But for various reasons, I think mostly deeply felt reasons by American foreign policymakers and the American foreign policy establishment, they thought that the United States needed to remain not only the superpower, but now the hyperpower. One, for materialist economic reasons, but also because they generally thought the United States was pushing the world with capitalist pushing capital A's history and capital P progress. So the struggle of the 1990s was to identify another enemy that would be worthy of these incredible defense outlays and this incredible foreign presence. And the enemy that was chosen was really humanitarian interventions. You have Somalia, which gave it a bad odor with the Black Hawk Down incident, but that was quickly, quote unquote, saved by the Balkans, Srebrenica, and later Kosovo, which basically seemed to provide a justifying logic for American empire. But these, I think, Derek, and I don't know, let me know if you disagree, I think these were weak logics. I think it was a weak logic to try to get Americans to basically do the same type of defense outlays for humanitarian reasons.
Right. It's weak for the kind of money that, right, that the defense industry wants to make, right? You can't justify a $1 trillion Pentagon budget on the basis of, you know, we're going to do some bombing in Kosovo to stop the Serbs, or we're going to, you know, try to get food into Somalia. Like, these are not missions that would make people think, yes, this huge outlay of money and, you know, building these massive weapon systems is necessary for this.
Precisely. And so to some degree, in an ironic sense, 9/11 was a godsend to the American foreign policy establishment. I want to emphasize, I don't think it was conscious. I don't think that, like, on September 12th, everyone got together and was like, oh my God, now we have this perfect enemy that we could identify as existential that could justify these absurd defense outlays. But I think there was what the theorist Max Weber, the sociologist Max Weber, terms an elective affinity between a genuine fear of quote-unquote Islamic extremism and jihadism, and this fact that now an existential enemy that was able to provide the United States with a grand ideological project was made clear. And so I think that we can't understand the cynicism of imperialist realism without appreciating the degree to which Americans actually believed in that project, and the degree to which that project utterly failed, whether you're in talking about Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or really anywhere that the United States tried to enact this grand war on terror ideological project. And I think has made Americans very, very cynical about the United States' ability to do good in the world.
So I wanted to get through that, to talk about that before we got into pop culture, because there is so much pop culture, as you talked about in Call of Duty, but thinking about like films and television, that is like trying to work out the angst over the failure of the war on terror. Like, how many movies are we going to get that are basically Iraq war pastiches, you know, where it communicates this sense of, it's all, I mean, the joke, I guess the flippant way to say it is shoot and cry, but it's, you know, do something horrible and feel guilty about it, which gets back to what you were saying about where politics are at and where liberalism in particular is at. And liberalism at this point seems to be an exercise in explaining to people why better things aren't possible. And, you know, sort of being the adult in the room who tells people you can't have, you know, anything that would make your life easier. It's just not going to happen. And I'm adult enough to say that to you, so you should elect me to office to be the adult. And of course it loses because that's a loser message and nobody wants to hear it. But you see, you know, liberal politicians all over the world making that argument. Keir Starmer just, you know, got run out on a rail after trying to be the adult in the room and explain to people why, you know, things suck and there's nothing I can do to change that. A lot of Democrats feel the same way. You get a lot of criticism of Democratic, of DSA, the so-called DSA candidates in Democratic primaries for promising things to people, having the temerity to suggest that maybe once they're elected, they might try to do something for that helps somebody out. And that's the same. It feels like a similar, you know, sentiment in a lot of pop culture, which is we're going to try to explain to you why these things were horrible and we feel bad about them, but also they were necessary. So let's talk about that strain. I think, you know, we can also talk about the other strain of this, the Marvel, you know, cinematic universe strain. I say this having just gone to see Spider-Man, but like, you know, the celebration of it in a more, you know, in a less conflicted way. But really what's interesting to me is this angst about it. It doesn't really lead you anywhere. It doesn't cause you to change your politics, doesn't cause you to do anything other than just feel kind of angsty and bad. And again, this gets back to, you know, everybody feeling bad all the time about the direction of things and feeling powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah, so Derek is teeing me up to talk about the third feature of imperialist realism, which is this notion that I call tragic guilt. And I think this emerges from the tensions between the cynicism on the one hand, the first feature, the missionism on the other hand, the idea that you need to act in the world, the United States needs to act in the world, which is the second feature. I think the tension between those leads to this notion of tragic guilt, which is this idea that the United States can't make the world a better place. It nevertheless must act in the world because otherwise someone else might, and that'll be worse. And so you feel guilty about it. And so what I think is key here, and I'm particularly indebted to the wonderful political theorist Jan Moorfield, whose book Empires Without Imperialism, Anglo-American Decline and the Politics of Deflection, argues that most of the empires in the North Atlantic world, or at least in Anglo-America, broadly speaking, have been liberal empires, that people don't identify themselves as imperialists. And one of the ways that they do that is through this notion of guilt. That as long as you feel guilty about how you're acting in the world, you're still a good liberal, and that nevertheless gives you the ability to act. And I think really that is a key feature of imperialist realism. And you see it with the Blinken statement that Derek mentioned earlier, which is that like, we need to act in the world because if we don't, someone else will. And that'll be a bit worse. He literally says that, which is just this notion of like this subtle admittance that you're really not going to be able to make the world a better place. You're not saying you're acting in the world to, you know, spread democracy. You just need to do it. Otherwise, someone else will. And so you feel kind of guilty about it. And this is, I think, really, really expressed in a lot of popular culture. I think that I talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, Captain America, Civil War, which basically is the one where there's the Civil War refers to the war between Iron Man's side and Captain America's side. And just to summarize it very briefly, there's basically a humanitarian tragedy at the beginning of the movie. Iron Man, the United Nations wants to regulate superheroes. Iron Man accepts that. Captain America, I mean, literally standing in for America, you know, not the most subtle metaphor. is like, no, I will never be regulated. And so the superheroes essentially divide between those who agree to regulation and those who don't agree to be regulated. And I think the key thing that happens is at one point, the superheroes that are on Captain America's side, that is the anti-regulation of superheroes side, they're imprisoned. Captain America frees them, and then Iron Man decides not to go after them. Like not to pursue them, sort of admitting that you need to have this rogue element in the world if you're going to structure a peaceful world. This tension is actually really never overcome in the following movie that sort of brings everyone together. I forget which one. I think it might be one of the final ones.
I mean, it's Infinity.
It's Infinity War.
Infinity War. It's the next Avengers movie. And they're separated in Infinity War. I'm revealing too much about myself here. They're separated in Infinity War, and then they all come back together in Endgame. But that's after the disastrous, you know, the genocide basically at the end of Infinity War. So there's no point in debating, you know, which side should you be on, registration or not, because this horrible thing has happened and they have to try and, you know, work together to reverse it.
Right.
So yeah, they do just ignore it. Like right. they just, it's superseded by right? something bigger.
There's the big octopus. Yeah. And so we all have to unite against the octopus.
Right. Exactly.
Which is the essentially like it's papering over the actual ideological disagreement with exogenous threat. You know, which is almost a literal, in this one, it is a literal deus ex machina.
Right. It literally is. Yeah. I mean, this is in addition to like, $1 trillion budgets, this is why you need an existential enemy who's like the enemy of all mankind.
Right.
To justify like US leadership, even though or the, you know, as you say, even acting in a rogue way, because it's for the greater good.
It's for the greater good. That basically the idea being, and this is another key feature, not a key feature in the cynicism, missionism, tragic guilt sense, but you know, a sort of notion that has, I think, been key to the American version of imperialist realism is the notion that there's always an enemy out there. And so you get that the reason that Iron Man lets Captain America go is that there's a notion that there's an enemy out there. And interestingly, you see this throughout a lot of pop culture. There's also, I discussed the Lord of the Rings show in there, which is this notion that Sauron, it takes place in the Second Age of the history of Middle Earth, not to get too specific, but basically Sauron has been defeated. And there's only one person, Galadriel, who really thinks that Sauron, of the elves at least, and humans, that really thinks Sauron is out there. No one believes her. Of course, she's right. Sauron is out there. And so sort of this fanaticism in the absence of evidence is taken as, you know, preternatural cognition that she's able to know something out there. You also see in the White Walkers in the Game of Thrones universe, it's the exact same structure, that no one believes that the White Walkers are coming. There's all these warnings, they're coming, there's an existential enemy, they're coming, and then they come. And so that is also a feature of imperialist realism, this notion that there's an enemy out there that needs to justify this sort of missionism, this acting in the world. And you see that throughout the entirety of popular culture. To some degree, you could even understand the sort of slow-moving zombie things as a form of imperialist realism. For people who've seen The Odyssey recently, that's what the sea peoples are. You know, there's this enemy that's coming. It's existential. You need to be ready to fight it. And so you see these things percolate throughout all of popular culture. And what I was trying to do in this book is sort of identify the reasons and the features of this type of imperialist realism that you really, once you get the concept, you kind of start seeing it in a lot of different places.
Yeah, The Odyssey does a little twist at the end there on this, the existential threat, but we won't spoil a movie for people. In the last bit of time we have here, you talk about the principles of a democratic socialist foreign policy as an alternative to the way things are structured now. Maybe we could end on the rare hopeful note for this show and kind of offer what your alternative is to the way things are now.
I think really we're in the moment of identification. I think the first thing to do is identify what is happening, and that'll be genuinely the first step on the path to changing things. And I don't want to get into the fascism debate at all, but I think one of the things that is important to me about that debate, or even about the reference to the language of the new Cold War, is that we're using basically 20th century frameworks to understand what I consider to be, and not everyone needs to agree, fundamentally new moments. So what I'm trying to do with this book is identify one of the features of our new moment, because identifying it would be the first way to figuring out how to change how Americans view their role in the world. I mean, to one degree, I think that material reality is taking care of itself. I think that when it comes to various parts of the world, first East Asia and maybe elsewhere, the emergence of other powers that are able to significantly challenge U.S. military power in an age of drone warfare is going to reduce the United States' imperial presence abroad. And once that happens, that might open up an intellectual space for people to rethink what the United States is able to do in the world. That remains to be seen. But what I would like to do is sort of blend in the future the municipal socialisms that we're seeing, especially in New York City, with more nation state level socialisms and anti-imperialisms that I don't think we know the key features of yet. But I think that the just the what I view at least as the inevitable reduction of American imperial power is going to force us to think about. So that is my current hope in the world. And I think if with enough people acting together, we could be able to reform the system. We could be able to introduce a more genuinely mass politics. We're not there yet, but I think we really can be.
All right. So this has been, I wasn't sure how this was going to go, but you're good on the mic. So, you know, this has been good. Thank you, Danny. If you ever write anything else, you know, let us know. We'll be glad to have you back on the show.
Well, thank you. But before we final plug, check out the Substack and please, if you do have an extra $25,
buy the book, Imperialist Realism, Politics and Culture at the End of the American Century. What are you doing? Buy the book. Yeah, seriously. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And thanks, Danny. We'll catch you later.
Bye.
I knew about investing, but I really didn't know how to go about it.
Meet Corey, a Wealthfront client.
With Wealthfront, I could put money in and it would automatically distribute it into a diversified portfolio. Then it starts to compound. The compounding compounds on the compounding. Just let it run and it's great.
Over 1 million clients trust Wealthfront. Get started at wealthfront.com. Client was paid $1,000 for their testimonial, creating a conflict of interest. Outcomes vary. Investment management and advisory services provided by Wealthfront Advisors LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investing involves risk to principal regardless of the strategy used. Past performance does not guarantee future results.
Right now, news and politics are moving awfully fast. It can feel overwhelming, to say the least. I'm Evan Osnos, a staff writer for The New Yorker. On the Political Scene podcast, we slow things down to understand how power really operates in Washington, D.C., and what it means for you. My co-hosts, Jane Mayer and Susan Glasser, and I have decades of reporting experience. And every Friday, we have conversations with insiders and experts to understand the forces remaking America. Join us Fridays for the Washington Roundtable from the Political Scene. On Mondays and Wednesdays, you can also hear insightful episodes from our New Yorker colleagues, David Remnick and Tyler Foggett, available wherever you get your podcasts.